Hey, this is Trevor Dunn from various bands that you may or may not have heard of, and you're listening to Vinyl Guide with Nate Goyer.
Well, hey everyone, it's Nate here. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast where we talk records and vinyl. And this week we are talking to an incredible musician, an artist who has contributed to so many bands I love and collect, Mr. Trevor Dunn. Now, you may know Trevor from his work with Mr. Bungle, Tomahawk, Melvins, Phantomos, even his work with John Zorn, King Buzzo, or Secret Chiefs 3. Trevor is an extraordinary artist, very disciplined, and has devoted his life to his craft of playing bass, and we are astonishingly lucky that he has. Now today, Trevor and I discuss many areas of his career, his beginnings in Eureka, California, the early days of Mr. Bungle, the arc of Disco Volante in California, his work with John Zorn, Melvins, King Buzzo, and of course, the new Tomahawk album, Tonic Immobility, available March 26. Pre-order your copy now. I've heard the whole LP. It is absolutely fantastic. Another winner from Epicac Records, one of the most consistently great record labels in history. Now, you could order the vinyl of Tonic Immobility at ipecacrecordings.bandcamp.com. And right now, you can download and listen to a couple of tracks from Tonic Immobility on your streaming service. Business Casual and Dog Eat Dog. Two tracks from Tonic Immobility. Tomahawk's new album, you could hear them now, and you'll be totally set up for the download of the full album once it becomes available March 26. Oh, and by the way, this is only part of the interview we did with Trevor. We have an extended version available only to our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/vinylguide. If you enjoy the Vinyl Guide podcast, please consider becoming a patron of the show. Not only do you get access to extended interviews, early access to episodes, secret episodes, and more, but you also help support this show and put a few burritos in my fridge. That is a huge help. So please go to patreon.com/vinylguide. Sign up now, get all the extras, and hear the rest of the show. And finally, if you're a fan of the bands Trevor Dunn has played with, check out these other episodes of The Vinyl Guide, including episode 243 featuring Dave Lombardo, drummer of the Millennium, talking all about playing with Mr. Bungle, Misfits, and more. That's episode 243 of The Vinyl Guide. Episode 246 featuring Bear McKinnon of Umlaut and Mr. Bungle. Amazing interview, episode 246 of The Vinyl Guide. Episode 211 with Buzz Osborne, aka King Buzzo of Melvins. Episodes 180 and 181 with Trey Spruance of Mr. Bungle and Secret Chiefs 3. Episode 167 with Greg Workman of Ipecac Recordings, and heaps more. Subscribe to the Vinyl Guide podcast on Apple Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And with the upfronts done, let's start today's interview with the amazingly friendly, talented, and hilarious Mr. Trevor Dunn.
Hey, Nate.
Hey, Trevor. How are you?
I'm hanging in there.
Yeah? Yeah? You seem to be...
We're getting blasted by snow right now. So we just had a pretty big storm last week, and the snow hadn't even melted yet. Now it's coming down again. So
far out. I spent last week surfing. So
nice.
Well, cool. We're not here to talk about the weather. You have been incredibly busy this last year. We're in a year where, you know, a lot of musicians unfortunately haven't been. You've had a couple of major projects come out, and I imagine still many more. Tomahawk, how did the new Tomahawk album come together?
Well, it's funny. That was, you know, a lot of stuff that came out this year had already been in the can, and that was a record that actually Dwayne, John, and I had recorded about, I think, 3.5 years ago or something. Dwayne had kind of, Patton was really busy, and Dwayne was kind of, I think, sick of waiting for him. So he's like, let's just make this record. So we flew down to Nashville and actually all recorded it separately, and then just kind of waited until Patton, the timing was right for him. And so this year he finally got to it.
Yeah, that seems to be a very similar story with Dead Cross and a few other projects. It's like it's kind of built together, and when Patton's got time, he'll sort of, okay.
Well, this is the only second Tomahawk record I'm on, mm-hmm. and you know, before, like, we were all in the studio together, and that's the way they're, you know, they did their previous records too. It wasn't really intended that way, but that's just kind of what happened this time.
Mm-hmm. Did you think Tomahawk was dead, or did you know that something else was going to happen? I mean, at a time of Odd Fellows or after those albums, the project just lays dormant. Do you know when the project is dormant or dead?
I think sometimes it's hard to tell, actually, but Tomahawk, I felt like it was, like I knew it was going to happen again at some point. A lot of bands I play with are like that. We'll make a record, do some touring, and then it'll be dormant for a while. And I don't really think about it too much because I'm busy doing other stuff. So, and then if it comes up, you know, hey, we're going to do this new record. Great. You know, so mm-hmm. that's kind of way the Tomahawk was. You know, Phantomas, on the other hand, this project of Patton's, I'm guessing is probably dead, but it's Patton's project, so I don't really know. You know, I don't know if he has other plans or what, but it's been so long for that band that it's probably safe to say it's dead.
Okay. All right. Well, just when you say it's dead, that's when
it
reignites. The other project, Bungle, did you think that was dead?
It's funny. I used to get asked a lot about that band years ago, you know, if we were going to reunite, and I would always give an adamant no for that. And which seemed genuine at the time, but also I knew somewhere deep inside that there was a slight possibility it could happen in some way, you know. And then I actually had the idea for this to re-record The Raging Wrath, and everyone was on board. That was actually a couple of years ago, and we kind of like decided to actually do it. And then it you know, it took a full 2 years for it to actually come to fruition. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't know, Bungle, we never officially said we were dead or called it quits or anything. It was just kind of, you know, faded into non-activity.
Were there any discussions or false starts in the 2 decades in between California and Raging Wrath?
No, there was some headbutting at, like, after the end of the last tours, like in 2000. And we all just kind of, I think, were sick of each other. So everyone just kind of went their separate ways and did, you know, worked on their own projects, and it was fine. And we took some time off from each other, and then we kind of started talking more, just as friends. Mostly Trey, Mike, and I, actually. And then it wasn't really, you know, we'd all had said it wasn't going to happen in interviews, you know, but we'd never talked about it amongst ourselves. So again, it wasn't official. It was just what we told the press.
So you kind of knew in your mind that, yeah, something could happen, but you're not going to lead anyone on.
Yeah. There was nothing definitive. There was no reason to say it could happen, but, you know, mm-hmm. keep people's hopes up, which doesn't seem like a smart thing to do usually.
Because you just invite tons of questions and speculation.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was just, you know, getting ready for this interview and going through your history, and I've been a fan of your work for years and years. And,
all right.
And I grew up in California, not too far far enough from Eureka, where it was certainly different cultures, but I was closer to San Francisco. But even in the larger cities, I never had the exposure to avant-garde music, which apparently you guys did in Eureka. How did that happen?
Well, I think once we got introduced to anything remotely unusual, we latched onto it and sought it out. I mean, you know, Patton worked at the main record store in Eureka, and so he could actually order whatever he wanted. And he was constantly ordering like obscure metal records that wouldn't sell, you know, but we'd always go and scoop them up, you know. And then when I went to college, I was, you know, studying 20th century composers and, you know, basically pilfering the library there and, you know, scores and records and stuff. And then we often, there were certainly times when I couldn't find certain things, and we'd have to drive down to San Francisco to go to Tower or Amoeba or Rasputin's or any of those stores, you know, that were all Virgin. They were all like right around in the same corner in Berkeley, actually.
Mm-hmm. Telegraph Avenue. We used to take Bart right up there.
Yeah. We'd be like, okay, it's record shopping day. We'd spend just like hours, you know, and we'd make trips just to go to San Francisco to see concerts and to buy records, essentially. Mm-hmm. Cause there wasn't much going on in Eureka. I mean, a lot of bands would skip going through Humboldt County. They'd take, instead of going up the 101, they'd take the 5, which was a quicker freeway. And then you could get from, you know, San Francisco to Portland in less time, you know. Yeah. But a few bands would stop in Eureka and play, and we'd go see those bands all the time. And a couple came to the university, and Art Ensemble of Chicago came to Humboldt State and, you know, were there for a week doing a workshop with us. And mm-hmm. some more obscure people, Horst Tapscott, this jazz piano player from L.A., came to Humboldt. Fishbone used to come up and play all the time. We used to see them all the time. No Means No was another band that would stop there. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit of a punk scene kind of before my day, but you know, there's always been a certain amount of creativity going on in Eureka, or in Humboldt County, I should say, in general. But
do you recall a record or an album or an artist that really just inspired you, where it finally clicked to where you thought, okay, this is what I want to do for a living?
Man, I guess there were a lot. You know, I got, my first teachers were great and were very inspirational. And I was in a band like within a couple months of picking up the bass, you know, because of my music teacher, my private bass teacher. You know, one of his other students was a guitar player who had a brother who played drums, and that was just immediately became a band. I mean, my first concert was Kiss when I was 11 years old. And that I've never
that
seen.
That wasn't in Eureka.
No, definitely not. That was at the Cow Palace in San Francisco.
Full and, makeup?
Yeah, full. It was Dynasty, the Dynasty tour. So it was very colorful. I don't think I've ever seen a concert that has topped it. mm-hmm. I mean, I was 11 too. My mind was fully blown. I mean, all kinds of stuff. Once I started playing in bands, I kind of never looked back. You know, I quit working at a pizza place when I was 18 to join this bar band. And then I was, you know, so I've been a professional musician since I was 17, basically.
Mm-hmm. And you and Patton were friends in high school. Yeah.
Yeah. And Trey as well.
Oh, okay. You all three went to the same high school, the same clique, the same group. Yeah.
Yeah. Patton and I went to the same junior high. We met there. And then that's about the time we decided to become metalheads and grow our hair long. And then we went to high school and met Trey there, and started Mr. Bungle when I was 17.
When you guys met one another, did Patton already have that voice?
No, not at all. It's funny. This band I was talking about with these two guys earlier, that we eventually formed into a quintet and had the singer. And at some point we just weren't into the singer anymore. And I don't know why, but I just asked Patton to join the band. I knew he was into music. We had a lot of similar tastes. We were constantly trading records. And I think maybe I heard him sing along to a record once or something. And I thought, okay, it sounds like he could kind of sing, but he actually couldn't really. I mean, some of those first recordings are, you know, and we were all like, you know, struggling to learn how to play too, you know, but we were taking lessons and stuff. He never studied music at all. So, I think ultimately for him, what helped was after the first couple of years of Bungle, when he joined Fade No More and went on the road, that's when he really developed his voice. You know, that's when it really, he got a serious workout from it. I mean, even that first Fade No More record, his voice, you can tell it's a little underdeveloped, mm-hmm. even though that's the record that made them hugely successful.
So understanding the timeline, he joined Faith No More and then developed his voice.
That's my opinion. Yeah. I mean, they hired him based on Mr. Bungle's first demo, which he's screaming his head off. He's not doing anything close to singing on that record. And so I don't know why, I don't know what they were expecting, but it's not what they got on that Faith No More record that he's on. So I think when he was in the studio with them, I mean, we'd already made a couple other demos too that he was actually singing on, and you know, we were writing melodies and stuff. So it was developing a little bit there too. But I think where he really got his strength was touring, because he just went out and toured constantly, mm-hmm. and totally came back like his throat was like ripped.
Well, there's the strength of the voice, the endurance, but then there's also the range.
Yeah. So
did he have that range early on?
He didn't have a wide range, but he always had a really good ear. He has naturally a really good ear. Like, in fact, I believe he has perfect pitch. You know, he was always good at like imitating other singers or, you know, and that's something actually, there's a Stockhausen quote, actually, the German composer talking about how the best musicians are able to imitate nature and imitate the sounds of nature and animals and stuff. And I think of really anyone who can really has a good enough ear to, you know, he's really good at with accents and kind of doing and you know, what do you call it? Impersonations, you know, that kind of stuff that all has to do with having a good ear and being able to, you know, control it with your voice, you know, which is, and then you kind of develop your own style, you know.
Mm-hmm. In your musical history, I'm sure you've had idols and people that you've looked up to and were really influenced by. Who are some of the musicians that had such an impact on you that you could even hear in your playing today?
I think Jaco was one, you know. I mean, he's like probably any bass player would say that. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard not to be influenced by Jaco. It's like, you know, Eddie Van Halen, right? You know,
he's just so exactly. Yeah. I mean, I got a fretless bass, you know, at one point you know, I was studying all the stuff that he did, and, you know, practicing, you know, I read interviews about the cello studies that he would practice. So I got those cello studies, you know, at a certain point I started feeling like, man, I'm starting to sound like Jaco, not even close, you know, spiritually to what he was doing, but you know, I could tell I was trying to sound that way. And I thought, man, maybe I should stop listening to Jaco for a while, you know, and I kind of did. I kind of stopped listening to Weather Report and stopped trying to play like him, you know, because I just felt like it was too imitative. So that one is a big one. And I still feel like I do stuff, you know, I mean, all the stuff I do with harmonics came from him, you know, and of course that led to other bass players who do that sort of thing. Kev Hopper, the bass player for this band Stump, this British band that was pretty obscure, he did some really cool stuff that influenced me. So,
Okay. So sometimes you could hear your own playing and say, like, "Oh, okay, I know where I bit that."
Exactly. Yeah. Playing fifths, I do. You know, sometimes I still do a lot of stuff with like parallel fifths and sliding. Like that's total Jaco.
Mm-hmm. Now, this last year, you know, obviously everyone spent a lot of time indoors. As a musician, you've got to practice. Are you a good neighbor? How do you go about your practice routine?
I'm not especially a great neighbor, but I have great neighbors who don't mind the practicing, and I have a housemate who's also a bass player, so I can practice anytime I want, which is great. I mean, I am respectful. I usually tend to stop by 10 p.m. at the latest, you know, but mostly I try to practice during the day. You know, I've definitely been in situations in my life where I did not have friendly neighbors and it was difficult to, you know, to practice. I usually practice with a mute on I practice upright bass more than electric. And so, you know, I can't really turn down or use headphones, but I do use a mute. There's this big plastic mute that I put on the bridge that helps, it kind of absorbs some of the low end. Mm-hmm. But I'm in a good situation where I can blast music all hours of the night, you know, it's fine.
See, I think if you live next to a musician who's really good at their craft, particularly upright bass or cello, you should actually pay more.
Yeah.
If I lived next door to a cello player, I'd just be crying all the time. I'd be weeping.
I heard you practicing. Oh, I'm sorry. No, please don't stop.
Yeah, please. I'm feeling very melancholic. What made you move back east?
Music, essentially. I mean, I lived in San Francisco in the 90s and was really active. You know, I was busy. I was playing music all the time, mostly jobs, you know, mostly weddings and restaurant gigs. And, you know, it was great. It was a really good learning experience for me. I was playing with a lot of different musicians, meeting a lot of different musicians. And then, you know, after I met Zorn, John Zorn, he kept encouraging me to move out to New York. And my friend Kenny Wallison, who's a drummer from the Bay Area, he also said, yeah, you got it, man, move out to New York. And so I basically moved out for to enrich my musical experience and add some color to my life, because I was just kind of stagnant and doing the same thing in San Francisco, which was fine. I could have kept doing that, but I just wanted to go to the next plateau, and that's totally what happened. I came out here, and I think I've played like one wedding or two since I've in the 20 years that I've been here. And one of them was like my friend's wedding. So,
okay. All right. So no more cover songs, no In the Midnight Hour, nothing like that.
Yeah. I'll do cover songs when I want to.
How is it different preparing for a session with John Zorn, say in comparison to like Buzz or Melvin's? Or
those are actually pretty different experiences. You know, with Zorn, I get the music in advance. I actually have some on my music stand right now. And you know, it's like 15 pages of music. And actually this recording session keeps getting postponed because of the pandemic, but I occasionally, you know, I practice that music. And actually the piano player made some recordings of himself, you know, playing parts, so I can actually practice to those. There's a lot more practice involved and like getting, you know, learning. There's a lot of complicated stuff that I have to learn, you know, so, and I want to be prepared when I go into the studio because he's paying us, you know, and we have limited time. So we kind of have to be efficient. With Buzz, it tends to be more, I mean, if I'm getting together with Buzz and we're going to play songs that have already been written and recorded, I'll just have to go back and relearn them or listen or whatever. But a lot of times, like for instance, the duo record that we made that came out this last year, was kind of unusual for me, even, because it was essentially, I was just going to record on a couple songs and then we were going to go on tour, and I got into the studio and he had already recorded a lot of the guitar parts. And so I just started kind of adding stuff to it, and he liked the way it sounds. So he said, hey, why don't you do another song? And before you knew it, it was like almost the whole record. So, and that was me just kind of listening to the songs a few times and getting a sense of them. And it was pretty impromptu, actually, you know, coming up with the bass lines. And then I'd have an idea, oh, maybe I'll do an overdub where I'm bowing some stuff, and like, yeah, sure. He's super open to anything, any ideas, you know. Mm-hmm. And we'll probably do one again, hopefully this year, but more collaborative, more like where we actually write the song together, you know.
So it sounds like you have a bit more freedom, a bit more expression in working with someone like Buzz or Melvin's or than John. John has a very clear vision of what he wants when he...
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of improv in Zorn's music, and he wants, like, Zorn will write a bass line, for instance, and then I'll learn it. And then as we're in the studio, he'll be like, you know, give me the done variations. He always says that, you know, like, don't play exactly what's written, kind of, you know, make it your own. And so I do have freedom to be creative in that sense. I mean, it's within confines, but to me, that's a good thing, you know.
Where would you recommend a novice start with Zorn's music?
Oh, geez. Well, I mean, the first thing of Zorn's that grabbed me was Naked City, which was a band he had in the 90s. Totally bonkers. I mean, that's, you know, that was a band that kind of defined genre, you know, splitting and using genres as a compositional tool. Mm-hmm. You know, you got your melody, harmony, rhythm, and then also genre. So it's like, I mean, his music has changed quite a bit in the last 20 years, but that to me, I think also someone who, if that's too much for them, then they might not go for the other stuff as well. So there's a sense of humor with that kind of music. It's really fast paced and it's kind of cartoonish. So it can be it's very visceral. So it can, you know, grab you right away. And, you know, because a lot of his other, like his classical stuff, you know, I mean, if you're not into 20th century classical, there's no point going down that road, you know, because he's definitely coming from that school, you know.
Okay. So Naked City, that's the entry point you'd recommend.
Yeah. I mean, that's a strange band to recommend as an entry point, but I think in Zorn's Irv, it would make sense. I mean, that's what it was for me. So, mm-hmm. And Masada is also, I mean, if you, the other thing, it depends what you're into. Like his Masada Quartet is a great band, kind of along the style of Ornette Coleman's quartet. If you're into that, you know, check that out. But that's kind of all of that, all the stuff that he's done is in Naked City in a way, you know?
Mm-hmm. We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, just a quick moment. I'm here to tell you all about the Groove Washer, the best record cleaner I've ever used. And man, I have used a heap of them. Some of them are fine, but I absolutely trust the Groove Washer. I mean, these are my records, man. I am not just going to trust any chemical compound on them, especially when it comes to storing. I've used Groove Washer for well over 5 years, and the records I cleaned in 2015 with the G2 fluid are still in beautiful, fine shape, no stickiness, no issues, no residue. So ask your local record shop for the Groove Washer by name and accept no substitutes. Or simply go to groovewasher.com and use promo code VINYLGUIDE10 at checkout. That's the Groove Washer record cleaner, promo code VINYLGUIDE10. Accept nothing less for your record collection. Oh, and one more thing, record nerds, make sure you head over to audiophileusa.com, the used record store that only sells near mint and excellent used vinyl records. Located in the record mecca of Southern California, audiophileusa.com somehow finds the best of the best records. Many ex-store stock, some still sealed for decades. It's incredible the stuff they find, and they will ship to you whether you're in Seattle, Sydney, Singapore, or Stuttgart. That's audiophileusa.com. Head over there now, dig deep, search by genre, artist, or even record label, and find the deals. That's audiophileusa.com. Go there now and find your holy grail.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
Do you have an opinion on free jazz?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I like it. I listen to it. You know, I like playing it. I know it's not for everyone. I mean, I also like playing traditional jazz too, but you know, so my opinion is, I mean, it's kind of the same as any genre in a way. It's like, you know, it's the more you like, the more rich your palate is, you know, and the more choices you have to listen to. So.
I've been dabbling with it, and of course I have to be aware of, you know, who's home when I play it. Exactly. But I also recently had Lou Donaldson on the show.
Uh-huh. Oh, nice.
He had some very strong opinions on free jazz, and they weren't complimentary.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, one thing that I can say is that it, you know, the word free is like, I mean, free jazz is like a genre. So the word free is like a misnomer now, you know, because it's becomes this style, like this, like sometimes even in New York, when people get together and improvise, there's like a thing that happens, this kind of messy arrhythmic thing. And that is kind of like, if it was really improvised or really free, it wouldn't always have to do that. You know, I mean, free jazz is a genre of jazz, which means it's freed up from, form and set harmonies and stuff. There's more, you can really, to me, Ornette Coleman is like the best kind of free jazz. Cause there are these tunes, there are these melodies, there's compositions. And then the playing it's in the style of jazz, but it's free, you know, they can, and that's really fun to play, but it is within constraints. They're not just completely improvising, going bananas, you know. Mm-hmm. That's also something, that's also a genre of music. But that's more like improvised, you know, right. I mean, there's a lot of subgenres, I guess, but I would assume that someone like Lou Donaldson or anyone who had a negative opinion about free jazz is probably talking about this kind of restrictions that the name has kind of caused.
Well, he was also remembering, Ornette Coleman, he would just drive people out of the club. You know, there wouldn't be anyone left when Ornette was playing. So that's the memory he had. But that made me think about, okay, you know, seeing David Cross do comedy and also driving people out of the club is fascinating.
Yeah. I'm all for driving people out of the club. I mean, I've been on stage with Zorn before where we'll, you know, play the first couple pieces or something and a few people leave and he'll get on the mic and say, okay, now that we got rid of all the people with taste, we can continue this concert.
You know what? That I always thought, going back to Bungle, Disco Volante, the first track, All My Friends in High School Are Dead.
Everyone in high school.
Yeah. I always thought that was a gateway. Like if you could get through that track, there was this amazing album. And was that part of the plan, part of the discussion?
I think so. I don't know if it was, I don't know if we consciously said that to each other, but when we were putting together the sequence for that record, it seemed like, I guess subconsciously, maybe we did talk about it. I don't know, but it seemed like that was the only place that song could go on that record, you know, it's like, man, we're just gonna, this record is not what they're expecting. So let's just be upfront about that.
What was the discussion around turning in a record that you knew was, look, at a minimum, it was going to be baffling, but, you know, it was more than likely going to be provocative to a lot of listeners. What was the discussion around that?
Well, you know, the magic of Bungle to me has always been that we've never really talked about that kind of stuff. We've never, after the first record, you know, the first record kind of came about from us developing as a band, getting together and jamming together, writing songs together. It was very collaborative. And then after that record, we toured, we did one tour, and then we took a bunch of time off. Patton was busy with Faith No More. Me and Trey moved to San Francisco and we're getting our lives together. And when it came time to start, you know, we had a contract with Warner Brothers. So we're like, yeah, I guess now we have to make a record. This is the first time ever that we're obligated to make a record.
And were you more or less starting with a blank slate?
Yeah. We didn't know what the hell to do. I think Patton was on tour. Me and Trey and Mike got, Trey and Danny, actually a drummer, got together and started jamming, you know. We had a little rehearsal studio where we could record and stuff. We just started kind of jamming and bringing in little ideas and stuff, but we had no concept of where it was going. And we didn't say like, hey, what should the second record sound like? We never said that. We just started bringing in weird ideas and recording them. And we did that for a while, for a couple of years, actually. There's tons of recordings of all kinds of weird little vignettes and riffs and weird little compositions we were writing. And then it just, you know, eventually those kind of each took shape, we threw out a lot of stuff, but eventually songs took shape and we didn't think about it. We're just like, here are these songs, you know, and each one was different, you know, so it just happened. You know, whoever kind of wrote the song sort of had charge in the studio in terms of like kind of producing it or the arrangement and stuff. Of course, we all collaborated together in the studio, but we just, you know, wanted to make each song good, you know, and interesting. And we had a budget so we could hire other musicians and spend time doing overdubs. I mean, the studio for us is like it's like kid in the candy store. You know, we love being in the studio.
All right. But you knew what you were doing was different than everything else out there. You knew that there was going to be some sort of people raising an eyebrow. There was going to be questions about it. Yeah,
I guess so. We didn't think about it. Luckily we were able to do what we wanted. I mean, we felt the same way about our first record. We just didn't, you know, we didn't think that it was, we knew we had our influences and we were trying to make things our own and, you know, and definitely being provocative sometimes, but I don't, you know, I mean, we knew that Warner Brothers was kind of, I think the only reason they kept us on there for so long was they were kind of hoping that they'd get another Faith No More record or something. And we actually at one point thought about, like, they kind of left us alone. They weren't breathing down our necks or anything like that. We just were left alone to make the records we wanted, which is great. But we, at one point we thought about Actually, I think it was might have even been before California. We thought about making a noise record, like a full on, like almost unlistenable mayhem noise.
Oh, like Lou Reed's machine music or whatever.
Yeah, some along those lines. And or you know, like, I don't know, whatever, maybe even more abrasive, who knows. But we had this idea. It was like, man, we got this budget. Let's make a noise record and then just submit that and see what happens, you know. But we never did that. We ended up writing a bunch of melodic songs instead.
Well, California kind of started kind of getting back to a little bit more of a continuum, perhaps, of what Warner Brothers was looking for.
Maybe, yeah. That's the thing. I think they thought, oh, they're maturing. They're starting to write songs. But I mean,
we finally got to them.
Yeah. But we knew the record after California, I mean, you know, despite Raging Wrath, we knew it was going to be different, whatever it was. If there was going to be a fourth record, we knew it was going to be completely different than California. Mm-hmm. And hopefully all the other records. And actually, Raging Wrath is so.
Yeah. Oh, it fits in the catalog perfectly. And the fact that it doesn't fit
anywhere. <yeah. laughs>
Did you have a record collection?
Yeah. I started, my parents had a good record collection. They still do. My mom has a bunch of great jazz records. And me and my brother both started collecting vinyl, you know, at a pretty early age. I didn't have a huge, I mean, by the time I left my parents' house, I probably only had like, you know, 100 records tops or something. But I just from there, just kept buying them. And, you know, I got a few thousand now.
Oh, so you still do vinyl, even in living back east in Brooklyn, where real estate is at a premium.
Yeah. I have a shelf that actually goes up to the ceiling. And I still do CDs, too. I can't seem to shake it. You know, I do it all. I do, you know, digital downloads and vinyl and, mm-hmm. you know, all this.
Is there a particular decision that you go through to where, whether you get the music on vinyl or CD?
Sometimes. Yeah. I really like used record shopping. So, and I have a tendency to go to like the classical section and in that section, I usually go to the one little bin that's 20th century, you know? So a lot of my vinyl is 20th century used vinyl, a lot of obscure stuff that is always pretty cheap, usually pretty cheap because it's a bunch of stuff that no one's ever heard of, you know?
Okay.
And, I don't really buy new vinyl so much. I tend to buy mostly used stuff on vinyl and CDs, it's a mix. I did buy something on vinyl online recently. Mort Gerson, is that his name? This guy, he did a Moog soundtrack. He's a composer. He did this shit. I have it right here. I have to look at it. Or did I put it away? I might have put it away. I was just listening to it. It's a record I just discovered. It was made in 1970, I think.
Mm.
So anyway, I bought that on vinyl.
Now, when you go out on tour, when you go out playing, do you bring back a lot of music with you?
It depends. If I'm in the States, yeah, because it, you know, usually I have to fly back to New York, which is difficult to do with a bunch of gear and, you know, records. So if I'm touring the States in a van, I'll buy a bunch of stuff. And then as we're passing through New York, I'll drop some off, you know. I still buy CDs on the road. You know, I try not to buy too much because I'm have my own CDs I'm trying to sell. So trying to make the case lighter, not heavier.
As the merch goes, you get more room to bring your own stuff.
Yeah.
Tell us your best vinyl record story.
There's a church a few blocks from me. Well, it's a school, actually. I don't know. I don't know if it's like a preschool. It's like a school/church or something. Anyway, it's about 6 blocks from me. And every year they have this big book sale. And they put up flyers and I get super excited. I'm like a little kid. I'm writing down my calendar. Okay, it's going to be next Saturday from, you know, 1 to 4 o'clock. And everything is like a dollar. It's kind of a madhouse. It gets packed with the neighborhood people and, you know, it's basically in the basement of the school. So it's jam packed and there's always a bunch of records and I always find something there. And one time I found a sealed Stockhausen record of, Microphony, this weird piece he wrote for gong and microphone. And it was sealed. I mean, that record probably would have been like, it's probably $30 online or something, you know? And I remember standing there like, oh my God, it's mine, you know?
That's interesting. Cause the record bins that you run to are not the ones that everyone else runs to, it seems.
Yeah.
Now, being back east, I imagine you're slightly unplugged from some things that are happening or opportunities on the West Coast. Were there any projects that you were offered or you could have participated in that you weren't able to, that you kind of regret not being part of?
I got asked to go on tour with Tom Waits, actually, and I had to turn it. This is actually when I lived in San Francisco. I sort of auditioned with him. He knew about me through some other people and actually called me up, and I went, actually kind of amazing thing. I actually went to his ranch in Northern California, and it was just me and him in this studio. And he sat down at a Rhodes. He's like, okay, just follow me. And he started singing and playing this song. And I just, with no music, I just like, he just wanted to see if I had a good ear, you know? And so I fumbled around and was like, you know, did that for a little bit. And then he, after that, he got a hold of me and said, hey, you know, I want you to go on tour. And I couldn't, because Mr. Bungle had just started booking our tours for Disco Volante. And I'm like, I had to turn it down. So that was,
Now, in terms of the new Tomahawk album, Tonic Immobility, is there a theme to it? What does the title mean?
The title refers to, that's something that Patton, you know, he wrote all the lyrics. Well, I think actually Dwayne wrote some lyrics too, but, you know, that band is really Dwayne and Patton's, and that's one of the bands I play in where I'm just kind of the bass player, you know, even though it's a solid quartet, you know, my creative input doesn't really go past that, you know, but from what I understand, the lyrics, that title is, it's that concept when you can, like if you pet an animal in a certain way and it sort of goes into a hypnotic state, you know, like if you rub an alligator's belly or something, and I think that's what it refers to. Yeah.
Okay. Is there a theme to the album at all?
Not that I know of. I don't really know all the lyrics, to be honest. So I don't know what, you know, I mean, there's some, I don't really know Patton's like formula for writing lyrics, but, you know, I think he kind of takes stuff from different places and tries, you know, he's really good at making things work as a vocalist. You know, it's a lot different than if I would write lyrics. I might write something that's awkward for a vocalist, because I do a little more singing now than I used to, but that's something I can actually kind of learn from him. I'm like, oh, you really have to think about the instrument, you know. You can't just like write, I mean, it's easy to write something difficult, you know. You could write a impossible to play clarinet concerto if you wanted. It's really easy to write something impossible, but to know what you're doing and use the instrument and in the way that's strong, you know, take advantage of its strengths. And that same thing with the voice, you know? So I think he always, when he's writing lyrics, he's constantly thinking about that. You know, sometimes, actually I lied when I said I don't know his formula. One of the things he does is he'll make demos that are just kind of phonetic. There's no lyrics, but he'll just kind of be almost like the way Fantomas sounds, you know, there's no lyrics, but there's this vocal expression and there's melody and stuff. And then he'll kind of fit lyrics into that. So like theme wise, not that I know of, but I can't vouch for that.
Yeah. It seemed there were a few words and phrases that I was picking out listening to the album. And I thought, yeah, this is something that is heavily influenced by the last couple of years. They seemed some very modern thoughts.
Definitely. And there's for instance, what's the song, Doomsday Fatigue, you know, there's definitely like, I mean, I think Patton wrote, as far as I know, he wrote all the lyrics this year, just like probably as he was recording the songs, you know, probably in the summertime last summer. So, you know, the pandemic was definitely on his mind.
back to Bungle really quick. When you were doing Raging Wrath of the Easter Bunny, was there a guide, a North Star for what went into the re-recording of it and what wasn't revisited, what stayed in demo land?
Well, most the demo in general was the North Star. We kind of decided right off the bat to eliminate 1.5 songs mm-hmm. that we just didn't feel like were made sense. Those, you know, the song Evil Satan and kind of the second half of the song Hypocrites were kind of, those were sort of leaning towards our later demos that we did in the 80s. And we just felt like, you know, this is, we really want to represent the band as it was initially started as a metal band. And there's still, you know, the stuff we did with Hypocrites and there's still hints of that attitude in there. You know, it's not your typical, it's still a Mr. Bungle making a metal record, you know. mm-hmm. But we wanted to stay true to the demo, to the metal stuff in particular, as much as possible. Even some of Trey's solos that were like really dear to us, like that hat, you got to do the same thing there, you know. And he's like, oh yeah, I think I remember what I did when I was 15, you know.
were there nerves about it at all, or was it just fuck yes from day one?
It was pretty much fuck yes from day one. It was like, it was super fun. Like once Dave and Scott were on board, I mean, it was, and in the studio it was totally a blast. I mean, it helped that we did those shows. We really were in good shape when we went in the studio and the record, we made it pretty quickly. We made it within a couple of weeks.
All right, cool. Trevor, thank you so much for coming on the show. I've always wanted to have you on again. I've always enjoyed the music and the projects you've been involved in. And I knew you'd be, have these fascinating takes, not only on, you know, just the rock records that we have, but also the avant-garde and jazz and everything. And I know our audience loves that sort of stuff. I do want to recommend everyone check out the new Tomahawk album, Tonic Immobility. It is out on March 26th. There are vinyl copies available at tomahawkofficial.bandcamp.com. I believe there's some limited pressings as well. There's one at Newbury Comics, and there's the International Coke Bottle Edition. Trevor, thank you so much for coming on the show. We hope to see you down in Australia at some point.
Hope to get down there. Thanks, man. Thanks for the support.
All right, there you have it, Mr. Trevor Dunn here on the Vinyl Guide. Wow, I have always wanted to have him on the show. He was always one of my top, like, wish guests, you know, to come on the show. And apparently it takes a Tomahawk reunion to make that happen. Tonic Immobility, March 26th. I've only heard the digital files so far. Can't wait to get my vinyl copy. Of course, you can get one too. Ask your retailer to make sure they stock them, and you can march in there on March 26th and pick one up. Or, of course, there's ipecacrecordings.bandcamp.com to have one shipped directly to you. And by the way, if you enjoyed this conversation, there's more of it. There's an extended interview up on our Patreon page, patreon.com/vinylguide. Join us up there and hear the rest of the show. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so, so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes across your social media. Show your friends who may not be as familiar with how to get podcasts on their phone. Show them how to be able to subscribe to The Vinyl Guide so they can enjoy it along with you. Something for you guys to talk about. You know, record nerds always love chatting about different things, so that's always a huge help if you could help spread the word that way. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.